The story of the terrors of the Islamic State may seem far away, but it's getting closer. ISIS is making headway in Asia. Graham Wood has covered ISIS as few journalists have. We'll talk with him about what ISIS wants and why it's looking to Asia. And a chilling scene of what happens when ISIS takes a city. Abdulaziz al-Hamza is a native of Raqqa, Syria, who risked his life to get the story of his city to the outside world. His story is the focus of a new documentary, City of Ghosts. Today, you'll hear it in his own words. And on a very different topic, the funding of arts in Hawaii. It takes a village, but it also takes support from the legislature. We'll get an update from a key figure in this discussion, Senator Brian Taniguchi. It's Wednesday, October 4th, day 8 of our fall pledge drive. Those conversations and more right after the news. A serious turn this morning on the conversation to Raqqa, Syria. It's a 2,000-year-old city taken over by the Islamic State, becoming the scene of public executions, brutal persecution of all who defy ISIS. The city is closed off. The only way the outside world can learn about the crisis there is through the work of citizen journalists. These men and women are risking their lives in a city where any attempt to communicate beyond the city walls carries a death sentence. They call themselves Raqqa is being slaughtered silently. My colleague Chris Vandercook spoke with Abdulaziz al-Hamza, one of the group's original members, about what has happened to the city of his birth.
ISIS came to my city in 2013, and they stayed there until January 2014 when the clashes started with the opposition. Back that time, they were able to control the whole city, and then they started to commit human rights violations against the civilians. Personally, I had to leave the city because I was an activist covering what's going on there, and they discovered my identity, and the same happened with a couple of my colleagues. So we had to flee Syria to Turkey, and when we got there and we were updated about the human rights violations from our family members, from our relatives, friends, and then we decided that we need to do something. And here when we started our group, Raqqa is being slaughtered silently, and or RBSS.
Yeah. Was it a gradual takeover when ISIS came to town?
So ISIS arrived to Raqqa City in April 2013, and step by step they started to change many things. It was the first time for me to see public execution in the city. It was the first time in the city itself. So then we noticed that there was something strange. We started to demonstrate against ISIS, and then step by step they gained more power. They were able to recruit many people, and then they started their fight with the other groups that were in the city, and then they control all of it. And after they control it in January 2014, they started to establish the rules step by step. Mm-hmm. So they didn't come with all the rules once.
So
they did it step by step, and then they got to a point where they change everything. And they started to show their brutality to the locals by doing the execution in several ways, just to shake them not to do anything against ISIS. Then in that time, we started our group and our organization to report about what's going on in the city, what's going on in ISIS territories, because ISIS prevented all the media organization to get to the city and cover what's going on. They wanted only their media offices to work, to be able to recruit people by spreading their propaganda online. So we were like the only group who could report or work from the city, because we're local. We used to do that things, our activities against the Syrian government, but we developed it to do it against the government and ISIS at the same time. And then the story started from there.
What kind of materials did you use? Cell phones, cameras, to document?
So we use all the tools that we can use. So we started with cameras, and then it was extremely hard to use a camera because it's a big device that could be organized.
Visible.
So, yeah, and then we started to use the mobile phones, and later on ISIS started to spread checkpoints all over the city. They spread cameras, security cameras all over the city, and their cars, the soldier fighters, they were like moving around all the time. So it was also hard to use the mobile phone. So here we started to use kind of security equipment to film. And sometimes when we check it safe, we use also the mobile phone. And later on, all the materials that our my colleagues in Raqqa collect, they sent it to me and my colleagues outside of Raqqa, where we publish everything online.
Each time you handled one of those materials, you were putting yourself at risk of your life, right?
It's true, because that's what happened with many of my colleagues. So we had executions, arresting, assassinations, and it was not only in ISIS territories. In other parts in Syria where is no ISIS, even outside Syria and Turkey, we had assassinations. And like for me in Germany, I'm getting threats all the time. So, yeah, so it was like a risky thing doing anything. And for me, I'm not in that risk comparing with my colleagues, because they're risking their life every single second. Any of them might be arrested, might be killed in any second. So for me, like all the time when I get a video from Raqqa or a photo, I just look at it, and the first thing I think about it, how my colleagues did take this photo.
How did they get it out of the city?
Yes.
Your group is called Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently, and the word silently implies that the worldwide media have been ignoring the story. Is that how it felt to you?
Yes, that's it. And it was like the media, the international community, and especially when we started our organization, but it was like in April 2014. So no one noticed ISIS. No one was talking about ISIS, both media, international community, even like other Syrians and like many Syrians in other cities. So they haven't heard about Raqqa and that atrocities that ISIS was committing there. So that was the reason why we said like silently.
From your perspective, you said earlier that ISIS, when they came to town, recruited some people, that some people actually joined them. Why would someone join an organization so brutal? What is the attraction? What is the appeal?
Yeah, so ISIS is using several ways to recruit people. Not all the people that they joined ISIS because they believed in ISIS or the ideology of ISIS. Mm-hmm. So talking about ISIS territories, people are living in really bad conditions.
In fear.
So where there is no jobs, where there is no ways to earn money, and where everything is getting expensive day after day. And many people, they have children they want to feed them. They have a family they want to take care of. And ISIS didn't force anyone to join, but they forced the people to live in these conditions, to force them to join in an indirect way. So many people, they had not enough money to feed their children. So they knew that joining ISIS means that they will get money in dollars. They will get a house for free. They will get cars for free. They will get gas for free. They will get oil for free. So many people, they went and joined ISIS only for that thing, not for other things. Others, they went and joined to get power. People who were, like, ignored in the community. People who were feeling weakness all the time. So they found ISIS as a way to get power or, like, to gain power. And then they turned to be leaders. And that's not only about locals, about foreigners. I've done many researches about foreign fighters who went and joined ISIS. And, yeah, I got many examples that many of them, they were, like, ignored in their community. They were in the jails. They were doing nothing in their community. They had no jobs. And then they went and joined ISIS, turned to be leaders, and then all the media started to talk about them. And others, they went to join for like women, for sex, for like several reasons.
And once they join, they might end up killing people from their own city. They might killing their fellow men and women, right?
Yeah, so, and that happened, like, in many cases, like, many brother killed each other, like, being in different groups or being in ISIS, and, like, son killed father and father killed son, and then we're living, like, in a tribal community, so that means the family is something valuable, but within ISIS they destroyed that thing, because right now you find like cousin killing each other, like family members, relatives killing each other, and that was like the way how ISIS pushed everyone. So ISIS wanted to break this strong relations between the family members itself, between the relative itself, and between the community itself. Because for us, like in Raqqa, the population of it in 2011, it was over 1 million. So, and in some point, every single person from those 1 million should know the other in some point. If I don't know that person, I might know his brother, his father, his cousin. If I'm not, my brother might know. So we should have links in some point. So they worked on breaking these links.
Once you break that fabric of society, people give themselves permission to start killing each other, is what you're saying.
Yes.
It's a very troubling picture of humanity, isn't it, Aziz?
For sure. Like, people, many people lost the feeling of being a human, because ISIS, the main thing after joining ISIS is being sent to an ISIS ideology camp where they teach everyone their own ideology. And then people, they leave this camp with like a brainwashing. So they lose the feeling of a human being. So that's the reason why you see them like bombing themselves, and they're smiling before they bombing themselves. They're going to the clashes, to the fights, and they know that they want to go and they don't want to return. And I was so surprised, like, if there is like a suicide attack or whatever, you find them fighting who's going to make it. So instead of like pushing each other, no, you go, yeah, you go.
They want to kill themselves.
Yeah, they fight. No, I'm going to go. I'm not going to go. So they fight to want to go. So that, like, when you lose your humanity, when you lose your feeling, you might do anything, and you might kill your family, you might kill any person, any human being, because you're not in your mind, and then you get to that point that you just want to die for having this idea of having 72 virgin. So sometimes, like, they focus on, like, one part of the human being, and, like, ISIS focus more on the sexual part of the person, like, being 18, 19 years old, and, like most of the people there, they haven't had sex. So focusing on that thing that you have, like, 72 women, they're more beautiful than the whole woman in the world, so they focus on that things and sending people just to be killed to get those 72 women, and like focusing on many other things and giving this way as a way of recruitment. So that made many people losing their humanity.
Aziz, were you raised in the Muslim faith?
Yes, and like a Muslim.
Does it seem to you that this is a perversion, a corruption of the Muslim faith?
Like, ISIS used the Islam as the way to have their popularity, to recruit people from everywhere. So, and like right now, the religion, it's an important thing, because if you're talking about Muslims, here you're talking about millions, if not billions. And then, so it's the easiest way to recruit a huge number is to focusing on the religion. And then, like, they've done many things against Islam. For us, like, Okaraka, we're like a Muslim community. We have, like, Christians. We have like many minorities. We had many nations. But for us, like, okay, we're like living in this peaceful community. And yeah, like, it's up to everyone if he want to practice his religion or not. So we had not that a problem. And when ISIS came, they changed everything. And the main thing that 95% of ISIS victims are Muslims. So they consider themselves Muslim. They say that they represent Islam. But when you look at their victims, they're like 95% Muslims. So 95% are Muslims. So and they affected like the Muslim people. And then they created this bad photo or like idea about Muslims everywhere. So many people, they started to hate Muslim just because of ISIS. So I faced that things many times in many cities and many countries only because being Muslim. So people started not to look at you up to your religion and like up to your color, up to many things. And ISIS was like the main thing how they created this heatness among the people against Muslims.
Abdulaziz Al-Hamza is one of the founders of this citizen journalist collective. Raqqa is being slaughtered silently. His story is told in the documentary City of Ghosts, which is being shown through tomorrow at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
Earlier in the program, you heard what life is like under ISIS from a citizen journalist who's a native of Raqqa, Syria. Now a deeper discussion of ISIS itself and its spread to Asia. Last year, Graham Wood wrote an article in The Atlantic called What ISIS Really Wants. He recently expanded coverage of that topic, added to it with the book The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. He's in town as part of a public discussion tomorrow at the East-West Center, ISIS in Asia. More on that a bit later. But to start, Graham, thanks for coming in. And as a starting point, what does ISIS really want?
Well, ISIS, it arose a few years ago with the idea that al-Qaeda had not been extreme enough. They thought that al-Qaeda, you know, they were sort of on the right team, but they weren't thinking big. And they believed that really what you need to get is all the world's Muslims to come together under one banner and not just take down a few of the enemy's buildings, but build up a state. And so what they believed was you couldn't be properly Muslim unless you were living under an Islamic state that was headed by one person called a caliph. So they kind of resurrected a lot of ideas from the very earliest days of Islam and tried to put them into practice in their own very distinct and very brutal way.
And a lot of this is really a return to medieval 7th century Islamic, I mean, public, not only public executions, crucifixions, dismemberments.
Yeah, we're talking about an attempt to return to the 7th century, and everyone, everywhere in the 7th century was conducting war, conducting private life in ways that today we would not consider acceptable. Things like slavery were just things that happened in any human civilization. So when ISIS tries to really take all those practices and then make them happen again, then of course it's going to look extremely brutal. And in a way that as the previous interview showed, most Muslims think is an abomination. But ISIS thinks it's just a compulsory aspect of the religion. We have to take even the most unpleasant aspects of our faith's history and put them right back into practice in the modern day.
Now, in a lot of your reporting, you've talked with some astounding people in terms of ISIS members and sympathizers. Talk a bit about how you have gotten to those people and how that has gone.
I've been very lucky in a way that if I were reporting on al-Qaeda 10 years ago, I'd have to find people who were trying to hide from me. Whereas with ISIS, because they're trying to reach everyone, they have to have people out there who are effectively spokesmen for their cause. And that means there are people out there who support ISIS openly, sometimes in free societies where it is legal for them to do so. And so I went especially to those people and said, okay, tell me about yourselves. Tell me where you come from. Tell me who you are. And then finally, tell me what you really want. What is this ISIS thing, and why are you willing to apparently throw away everything that you have in support of it?
You know, I got a flash on Daniel Pearl, though, the Wall Street Journal reporter who, again, in pursuit of the story, going through, oh, you got to meet this guy, come over here, I know this guy who knows this guy. And in circumstances like that, that's the way reporting works. And aren't you concerned for your safety?
I have had concerns. You know, with most people I met, there would be a moment in the beginning where I'd be looking them in the eyes, they'd be looking at me. And there was a moment of trying to assess, is this person plotting something that I can't tell, something that I don't want? And you know, Daniel Pearl paid with his life for a bad decision and a meeting with very, very awful people. Now, in my case, once I started asking questions of them, I could start to get a sense of whether they would like to talk to me if I brought up topics that they themselves were interested in. You know, that, like I say, they had dedicated their lives to this idea that ISIS is the only way to be Muslim. So if you ask them, tell me what's most important in this world to you, I found in most cases they couldn't even stop themselves from talking to me and trying to get me to stick around for the rest of their answer. I was mostly in danger of being overfed by them rather than being beheaded.
Okay, so for most of America, you say ISIS, and you see the video of the masked people in the black robes and the marching through and all of that. And that's maybe about – and beheadings, and that's maybe about it. What is it that needs to be more deeply understood in this country about ISIS?
I think when we see those images, we think of them purely as a destructive force, and they certainly are that. What we don't really see, unless you look a little bit deeper, is the constructive aspects of ISIS in its own eyes. For us, this is purely evil. Now, for them, they have a kind of idea of paradise on earth. For them, it's building something. It's an exciting project of construction. Whereas for us, it just looks like a bunch of awful people just trying to create mayhem.
Territory is a very important concept to ISIS. And territory, and part of that is as we move to sort of ISIS in Asia, that has been mentioned as, for example, in the Philippines most recently and most obviously, I guess. But talk a bit about that.
Well, Al-Qaeda had the option of taking territory and keeping it. Mm. And they decided that's a bad idea. They just said, we don't have the ability to create a government. We don't have the support of enough people. Whereas ISIS said, if you can take territory, then you can create this Muslim government that we're obligated to create. So as soon as they were able to do that in Syria and Iraq, they did it. And for the last couple of years, their main project, in addition to terrorist attacks on the West and elsewhere, has been to find other places that are candidate territories. And the southern Philippines is one of those. They'll look for any place where there is a concentration of Muslims and a lack of trust in whatever currently existing authorities there are. So Mindanao, southern Philippines, great example of a place that has a long-term Islamically tinged insurgency and not a lot of trust in the central government by those Muslims. And so they say, aha, this is perfect. We will send our people in. We will teach them. We will teach the local people in Mindanao about the ideology of ISIS, and eventually we'll use our expertise in destroying the government and then finally use our expertise in constructing one in our own model.
Indonesia, frequently quoted as the most populous Islamic nation in the world, and yet the brand of Islam, if you will, a little more tolerant than some other places, again, depending on where you are and what circumstances. Is that an area as well that is ripe for ISIS or that they're
I was working. Actually just in Aceh, Indonesia, where there is an implementation of Sharia law.
Yes.
And, you know, some might expect that because there's an appetite for the implementation of Islamic law, there would also be an appetite for ISIS. And I found exactly the opposite. It was as if the ability to implement Sharia law in a kind of local way, inflected in the local traditions of Islam, had displaced any ability of ISIS to recruit. Now, there are, of course, Indonesians who are with ISIS in Syria, in Iraq, so they've traveled and they're fighting. But it's very interesting to see what acts as a substitute good for ISIS. In some cases, actually, other forms of Islam and perhaps even conservative forms of Islam or even forms of jihadism turn out to be a kind of immunity, to confer an immunity against ISIS.
You know, as a closing thought, what is it that Americans should watch for, monitor, just watch for in the news in terms of clues about where ISIS goes or what comes next?
I think we need to notice that the places that ISIS finds most attractive are the ones that lack a coherent and trusted form of government. So the southern Philippines is one place, Nigeria is another. We could just go around the planet Earth and find the little spots where people just don't trust their governments and they view their governments as predatory. If those places also have a certain critical mass of a Muslim population, then they're probably on ISIS's radar as well. So we need to watch for that.
Thanks very much. Graham Wood, a national correspondent at The Atlantic, lecturer in political science at Yale, started in journalism as a reporter for the Cambodia Daily in 1999, has written for publications from Business Week to The New Yorker. Earlier this year, he published a book, The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. He was also 2009 Jefferson Fellow of the East-West Center. Tomorrow, he'll be taking part in a public discussion of ISIS in Asia at the East-West Center, along with several other journalists who have taken part in the center's media programs. Full disclosure, that includes me. I'll be moderating that event tomorrow at 5 p.m. at the East-West Center's Hawaii Imin International Conference Center at the University of Hawaii. Graham, thanks for joining us.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation in support of the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the Akira Kurosawa Retrospective, October 7th through November 2nd. Schedule at honolulumuseum.org.
It's been a big year for art in Honolulu. In February, Powwow was another success. Then we hosted the Honolulu Biennial with various installations around town. Since then, there was a Smithsonian Museum pop-up at Ala Moana Center, and as condos continue to go up around town, a lot of them are decorated with local art. State support for the arts starts at the legislature. One of its biggest backers is State Senator Brian Taniguchi. Among other things, he's the founder of Art at the Capitol, the annual open house where constituents can check out the art in the offices. Next year will be the 10th anniversary. Now, no one covers art like my colleague Noe Tanigawa, and she recently sat down with Senator Taniguchi and started off by asking how he thought the Honolulu Biennial went.
How do I think it went? I think it went okay. You know, I think for a start, I think it was a solid start, I think. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they had their ups and downs and their little problems and issues and stuff, but generally speaking, I think, you know, it came off all right, and I was expecting a little less, but, you know, it's a little bit more than what I thought. And certainly, I think there's room for improvement, but I think, you know, for a start, I think it was, you know, solid. It's good. It's a good start. And
what was the state's investment?
Did we give them all $300,000? I forgot. I don't know how much was released at the end, but I think their granting aid was, I think it was like $300,000. Yeah.
Would that have been a good investment for the state? Could you make a case for that?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I think that's it's hard because they're doing it for the first time. And so they, if you're doing things for the first time like that, it's more difficult. And I think I was hoping that once they kind of establish it, they'll be able to, you know, pick up more money and, you know, get more corporate contributions and stuff later. But I think the timing was kind of good in the sense that they were lucky in the sense that the Sports Authority was open, you know, and they had a venue. They had to me, it was a good venue. And I think, you know, I don't have any real problem with what they did with it. So
I thought it was better than I thought it was going to be, too.
Yeah. And so, I mean, so, you know, so I thought it was a good start. And I think that hopefully they have room to grow, room to improve, and hopefully they will. And I think that once they do that, I think they're going to be off the ground. It's going to be like a biennial event, I think, you know. So that's what I'm hopeful for.
When you look across the, you know, the business landscape or in Hawaii, what kind of businesses do you think would support something like this?
Well, we don't have the old big five that or a lot of the in the past to either whatever Academy of Arts or, you know, whoever it was, you know, who supported, you know, big art stuff here. So we don't really have that now. So we have to kind of look to other people, maybe more people to, you know, donate or whatever, or participate a little bit, you know, more. But we don't really have the big donors. It's kind of like, UH, you know, they don't have the big, you know, Nike guy to, you know, kind of build all kind of sports stadiums for them or anything. You know, you don't have that. So you got to kind of scratch and claw and do, you know, I think you got to cobble together, you know, as big a group as you can. That's what I think.
And we're like looking at all the sort of, say, mid-level and small local businesses.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there has to be something sort of in it for them, you know. I think that there has to be some sort of attraction or some sort of, I don't know if they're going to get much PR off of it, but you know, there has to be something in it for them. And I think the fact, but you do have some corporate guys, you know, people like maybe Ala Moana or Ala Moana Center or Howard Hughes guys.
Howard Hughes.
Yeah, they jumped in kind of big, so I think you got to cultivate them more and maybe get other similar type, you know, people. I don't know.
Do you see any way to?
Well, you know, we got Disney out that side too, you know, so we haven't really tapped to me into Disney generally as a corporate citizen, you know. But I don't know. That's not my job.
I think you're right on that.
Yeah. So I think. Yeah. So I don't know if they would do it on, you know, on arts, but we haven't really, as a state, I don't think we've tapped into that.
And even the Four Seasons people.
Four Seasons people. You know, all the hotel guys, right? Japan. But I think that the art side, we got to be strategic about placing whatever, or advising those people who are doing these things to try to place them together so we get more synergy with that, you know, stuff.
Maybe joining up with one of those Japanese festivals that just does not seem to have real traction here, would be a good thing.
Yeah, like Pan Pacific, they get people from all over the Pacific Rim.
Do they?
Yeah. But like I said, you know, have their own thing, we got our own thing. But I think part of it for us is trying to be sure that we kind of get them, at least in terms of time, try to get them around the same time so we can build on that stuff. But and have people, you know that this is happening, so they can do stuff that's related, you know, in their own little shop or in their own little store.
I hear what you're saying, and that is so, that's great. That's what our community could do.
That's what I think we should be doing, yeah.
You know what else? This, I know you got to go, but last question. We must have had an arts council here in Hawaii before, right? Do you know what happened to it? And would it be good to have one now?
I think we need something that helps to coordinate some of the events and stuff. We don't really have that. Yeah, because State Foundation, they do public stuff. And Alliance, they do advocacy for stuff. But we don't have somebody that can see that and kind of work on building all these kind of bridges that need to be built, you know, to... if we're at the biennial again, you know, maybe we need to get the hotel guys to sponsor, you know, something, you know, so that there's some kind of link. Or I mean, certainly the retail guys, we don't have any real big retail anymore, but maybe we can get Ala Moana Center to do some down there, you know, a 1 day or 5 day thing, or they have a space that like Foodland that's open that, you know, maybe we can use that and all that. So that kind of stuff. I think there isn't that kind of sense yet, or there isn't anybody doing that, you know. And I'm sure it'd be relatively volunteer at the beginning, but you know, you don't have anybody that's really kind of coordinating,
working on that
kind of vision.
Because you would think that Howard Hughes, General Growth, they wouldn't want to if you make it easy enough for them to.
Yeah, it'll grow on its own, I think. You know?
Once you start putting the people together.
They'll start doing the stuff, and they'll get their people, then they'll get their people. And, you know, that's kind of what we want. You know? So that's the kind of thoughts I have.
Putting people together, That's part of what we do here at Hawaii Public Radio as well. That is the conversation for this Wednesday, October 4th, day 8 of our pledge drive. We'll get back to Pledge Central now, and my friend and colleague Ray Cruz. Ray.